Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. A moment in time. Sometimes that's all it takes to shift a relationship, change a perspective, alter a future. In this week's episode, we relive one of those moments with Golden Globe and Emmy Award-winning actress America Ferrera, known for ABC's Ugly Betty and NBC's Superstore. Fasten your seatbelts as she reads Mara Gordon's modern love essay, Broken, Not Bound by an Intimate Tie.
This guy wasn't right for me. He smoked cigarettes, his teeth were stained, his hair always looked a little dirty, and he had a propensity for heavy drinking and Afrikaans cursing. Yet, there I was, my calf touching his in the sticky heat as the bus hurtled through the Tanzanian countryside. I told myself this was my adventure, the kind of story I could someday tell my children to prove I once was brave and interesting. Wedged into a three-person seat behind the driver along with a sullen teenager, we had to lean in close to hear each other over the roar of the engine. "Look at the moon," he said, gesturing to the rising dusk. "This is going to be a good trip." I group the expatriates in East Africa into three categories. The ex-colonials, residually racist types who ran exploitative businesses and drank heavily. The religious missionaries. And the aid workers, many of whom also drank heavily but had convinced themselves they were saving the world. I was in the last group. Most of my friends and I were there on short-term assignments, selling solar-powered lamps and researching Swahili sign language for dissertations before returning to our lives back home. I was working in public health, entertaining dreams of being a foreign correspondent, as I prepared for a more realistic option. Medical school. I was, as I would say with a smirk, in it for the long run. That meant a year in Tanzania, maybe two. After a string of romances with men who had finished their work and left the country within a few weeks of kissing me, 2 years in this transient world felt like a long time. This man defied the easy categories I had come up with. He was living in Dar es Salaam indefinitely. He had grown up in Africa, and although he had family in the Netherlands who urged him to come live in Europe, he chose to remain in Tanzania, working for a tourist company and taking wealthy foreigners on safari. He loved being outdoors, in the national parks, to which he would retreat for weeks at a time. That was how he persuaded me to go away with him. He described the beach at night, the sounds of Africa around us. "It's going to be wicked," he said, "and I'll finally get to share a tent with you." And so there we were, zooming northward from the city, our arms barely touching. As the sun set behind us and the moon rose in the front window, I was wondering what it would feel like to kiss him. When suddenly there was a blast of impact, a deep crunching, and I felt shards of glass spray my face. After a moment of quiet, the screaming started, long, deep wails and shrieks. We had crashed somehow. "Don't panic," I said, surprising myself. "Don't panic." "I'm not panicking," he said. His face was covered in blood. Behind us, passengers moved about slowly. I saw our driver jump out through the smashed front window, darting from the scene. "We need to get out," I said. We followed the driver's path out through the broken front window, and once outside, I doused a t-shirt with water and used it to wipe his face. I had thought the blood was his, and it shocked me to realize most of it wasn't. He was barely bleeding. The bus had sideswiped something, and everyone behind the driver on the right side was uninjured. I found only a few flecks of glass in my forehead. I couldn't bear to look down the left side of the bus. Meanwhile, a large crowd had surrounded the crash scene, a seemingly hopeful sign. But soon it took on a menacing air. Later, I would learn from news reports that a looting spree was about to break out, with some finding opportunity amid the death, injury, and chaos. We knew we had to get out of there, but by then I was in shock, huddled on the ground, unable to move, overtaken by a kind of paralysis. My guy was becoming himself again, haggling with an onlooker in a mixture of Swahili and English, until the man agreed to drive us to the nearest town where we could spend the night. Many in the crowd were becoming agitated, shouting and climbing on the crumpled vehicle. As we drove past the destroyed bus, I didn't let myself look inside, but I could see what we had hit. A flatbed truck full of lumber parked in the middle of the dark highway. I closed my eyes and told myself to stay calm. When we arrived at the hotel, the manager led us to a room with one double bed, clean and austere, a Bible on the bedside table. My guy and I looked at each other. It felt over for us. Nothing would ever happen now. When I woke up the next morning, he was pacing outside on his phone, arranging for a friend to pick us up. We had spent the night inches from each other, not touching, falling asleep only after splitting a sleeping pill I had in my bag. Back in Dar es Salaam, we went straight to the hospital. I knew what I wanted, Combivir, a medication used to help prevent HIV infection when someone may have been exposed to HIV-positive blood. On Monday, my roommate showed me the newspaper headline that announced the devastating toll. 27 people had died in the crash. And many of the dead and injured had been looted for their valuables by the mob. It was just too much to take in. In the accident's aftermath, I started to ignore him. I avoided his calls. When he showed up at my apartment later that week, I let my roommate talk to him. When I finally came out to say hello, he looked shaken, fidgeting with a pack of cigarettes. I could tell he wanted to talk about it, but the thought made my stomach turn. I didn't want to explore the awfulness of what had happened or my guilt for having survived. I was in denial, and part of my denial was denying him. I just wanted my private moments of gratitude, feeling the sun on my arms and my muscles moving when I jogged after work. "Why are you avoiding me?" he texted. I didn't respond. Sometime later, I met an American man I had been introduced to by a mutual friend back home. He was more like my aid worker friends, a cerebral and shy academic who impressed me with his schemes to improve rural maternity care. And there was comfort in that, in his familiarity and seeming goodness. Falling into an immediate and urgent romance with him felt like reinforcement that I was alive. I didn't tell the safari guide about him. I rationalized that I didn't have to, since nothing romantic had happened between us. But when I brought this new man anywhere I knew I would see the guide, I avoided his eyes. I felt as if I had betrayed him. I wondered if it stung him during those next few weeks to see me with another man, just as it stung me to see him with his arm slung around some skinny girl in the thick Dar es Salaam night. Our short-lived relationship hadn't been a romance. We had barely touched. Yet we had shared something so intimate. It was unspeakable and ultimately unbearable. A few feet away from us, 27 people had died, and we had lived.
America Ferrera, reading Mara Gordon's essay, Broken, Not Bound by an Intimate Tie. We'll hear more from Mara Gordon right after the break. We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and now a postscript from Modern Love editor Daniel Jones and the author of the piece you just heard, Mara Gordon.
I found it really hard to talk about at the time, as I sort of wrote about in the piece. And my roommate insisted that I go to therapy. So I went to this British, I think she was a psychologist, I'm not sure what her background was, who was living in Dar es Salaam. And you know, the first thing she told me was that the expat community in Dar was very small, so if she saw me in a grocery store or, you know, at a restaurant or something, she would not acknowledge me. And I understand where she was coming from, but I feel like that sort of set the tone for our therapeutic relationship, and I think I found it really difficult to be a patient. My mom said, was it therapeutic for you to write this and to publish it for such a wide audience? And I definitely feel that way. I think sort of plowing ahead was how I coped with what had happened. It's still a little hard for me to talk about. It just feels so, feels abstract at this point.
You have this incredibly weighty story up against this very light story, which is her flirtation, and they don't match. One story is enormous and the other one is small. But in a way, that's the point. She couldn't reconcile how unequal they were. Also remarkable in this story that she really gets to the meat of is intimacy is not always just a positive thing sometimes. Like in this case, intimacy is enduring this horrible thing together. And it almost brought them too close too fast. You could be perfectly well matched for each other, but something happens that's outside of your control that takes the air out of the balloon, you know, and there's no putting it back in. It's too damaged.
So I have not really been in touch with the safari guide. When I was still in Dar es Salaam, we were part of the same peripheral group of friends, and I would see him around. But the lightness and the flirtation, all that was totally gone. The guy I mentioned at the end of the piece, who I met literally a few days after the crash, he and I had a short but meaningful relationship, and he read it. And he sent me a very kind email after it came out. He said that he always felt like I was withholding something about what had happened in the accident. And now he finally understood. And I think we both got a little closure from the publication of the piece, which was really nice.
Mara's essay for me raised a delicate issue of Western involvement in third world countries, this idea that they're there to help, but they're sort of interlopers in the lives of people who are less fortunate than they are.
In certain expat circles, in people working in foreign aid or global health, there can be this tendency towards one-upsmanship in terms of the hardships that Westerners endure in their travels. And, you know, there's sort of this bravado, I'm so adventurous, I rode such a crowded bus. I think being in the bus accident really changed how I think about that kind of attitude and the role I inhabit as an American when I travel. I think that attitude can be kind of disrespectful towards people who have no choice but to endure those circumstances, and I try to be respectful of that.
Mara Gordon's experience in Tanzania was life-changing, to say the least. She returned home after a year in Dar es Salaam, but was soon back on a plane doing more public health work in Africa, this time in Malawi. She spent a year there, and Mara now lives in Philadelphia, where she's focused on issues closer to home.
I see myself working to fight health inequality in my own community these days. That may change. I still love to travel. I'm not ruling anything out, but we have a lot to work on here in Philadelphia, and I feel pretty excited and motivated about that.
Mara Gordon, author of Broken, Not Bound by an Intimate Tie. Mara graduated from medical school last year and is in her first year of residency training as a primary care doctor. You also heard from Daniel Jones, the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. And special thanks to America Ferreira, who read this week's piece. You can see her later this spring in the Netflix original film Special Correspondence, starring Ricky Gervais and Eric Bana. Next week on Modern Love, author and professor Jennifer Finney Boylan. You might have seen her in the E! Network's documentary series, I Am Kate. Jenny reads her own Modern Love essay about coming out as transgender to her sons.
"We can't keep calling you daddy," he said, "if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird." "Okay, fine. What do you want to call me?" Zach thought it over. "I know," he said. "Let's call you Maddie. That's like half mommy and half daddy." "Maddie might work," I said. "Maddie might just work."
Well, I have a hunch that you like Modern Love. But do you like us? Well, let's make it official on Facebook. Follow Modern Love at facebook.com/modernlove. And please do let us know what you think of this week's episode. Now, can I just say for one second that there's something strange about this whole world of podcasting? Because I sit here in the studio, the producers put together the podcast, and then you, wherever you are, you download it somewhere and you listen to it. You know a lot about us, but we want to know more about you. So there's a quick survey we're asking listeners to fill out. It's short, easy, and it's fun, and we would love for you to participate. So go to wbur.org/modernlove and let us know who you are. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast courtesy of APM and the Go License Collection at ghostlysongs.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.